Lots of gods, that's fine. The problem, of course, is that Christians believe in one God. So that's where the tension there was. And so Christians were hunted down and persecuted because they didn't want to worship other gods, especially the emperor, who was seen as deity, as divine. Now, around this time, while the Christians were being persecuted and martyred for the faith, the main worship had been in house churches. There's still some surviving right now, some archaeological findings of house churches. And usually it's owned by a wealthier family. A bigger house that's converted for worship. And around this time, the bishop of a place was the presider for Mass. It was much more, a little bit more intimate, closer. Just imagine your life is in danger. You could be killed anytime. And you would meet together in a house church secretly, usually at dawn, to worship God. Now, some of the worship also happened in catacombs, a sort of underground graveyards where the martyrs were laid. And so there's that sense of continuity of admiration for those who gave up their lives for the faith. So they, Christians, celebrated the sacred mystery of Jesus' death and resurrection by sharing bread and wine, which they believed became the body and blood of Christ. So here we have an example of an early church, house church. And usually Roman houses had a central courtyard in the middle of their house. And then usually on three sides or four sides, you would have the rooms of the house. And it's the dining room, one of the biggest area, the cenaculum, that ended up becoming the place where Christians gathered for worship. So the dining area became the assembly space of some sort. And then in house churches, you also had a separate room that had sort of a bath, a baptistry. That's where they baptized people. Oftentimes, there were also wells around there in house churches. And so there's that symbolism of water early on for Christian initiation, for bringing in new members of the church. Any questions? Yes?
I'm just curious. I see it says where they believe that the bread and wine became the body and blood of Christ. Has that always been believed from the very beginnings of the church?
Yes. And so, I mean, you've probably heard from the Gospel of John, chapter 6, Jesus had this long monologue about my flesh is true food and my blood is true drink. And then it says there that some of the followers ended up leaving him. And it's a hard saying. And so Jesus didn't tell them, okay, I apologize, it's just a metaphor, it's real. And so he even asked his own disciples, own apostles, are you going to leave too? And that's when Peter said, no, to whom shall we go? You have the words of everlasting life. So as far as we know, even in Scripture, Christ himself testified that his flesh is true food and his wine is true drink. So, excellent question. Okay, so next we have a description in the early church from the 2nd century. And this one you can actually find in the Catechism, paragraph 1345. So this is part of a letter that St. Justin Martyr wrote to the emperor, to the pagan emperor. He said, on the day we call the day of the sun, all who dwell in the city or country gather in the same place. The memoirs of the apostles and writings of the prophets are read as much as time permits. We still do that. We still have the readings in the Gospel. When the reader has finished, he who presides over those gathered admonishes and challenges them to imitate these beautiful things. What does that sound like?
Homily.
I'll take a sermon. Then, we all rise together and offer prayers for ourselves and for all others, so that we may be found righteous by our life and actions, so as to obtain eternal salvation. What does that sound like?
Petitions.
Okay. When the prayers are concluded, we exchange with a kiss of peace. Now, throughout history, the sign of peace has moved somewhat. There were some liturgies that testified that the sign of peace was after the intercessions at first, and then later on it moved to after the Our Father. But around this time, it seems that the sign of peace, the kiss of peace, as it was called, was right there. Then someone brings bread and a cup of water and the wine mixed together to him who presides over the brethren. Sounds like offertory. He takes them and offers praise and glory to the Father of the universe through the name of the Son and of the Holy Spirit. And for a considerable time he gives thanks, Eucharistian, that we have been judged worthy of these gifts. This is the Eucharistic prayer, the consecration. Exactly. When he has concluded the prayers and thanksgiving, all present give voice to an acclamation by saying,
Amen.
Do we still do this?
Yes.
We do, the great Amen. After the through him and with him and in him. And then, when he who presides has given thanks and the people have responded, those whom we call deacons give to those present the Eucharistic, the thanksgiving bread, wine and water, and take them to those who are absent. So this is from the Catechism, they quote Justin Martyr's letter. And you can see the fuller version there if you'd like. So one important thing One important change that will come with the history of worship is the legalization of Christianity. Who was Emperor Constantine? I'm sure you've probably heard of that name. Does that sound familiar? Some of you? What did he do? Who was he? Yes. Yes, exactly. So he became Christian. So he was one of the two generals that were leading Rome. Around that time, instead of just one emperor, the empire, the Roman Empire, was sort of divided into two. There were two generals leading. So he was one of them. And there was a great battle, the Battle of Milvian Bridge. And that's when he won that. That's when he reunified the empire. And supposedly, before that great battle at Milvian Bridge, he had a dream or a vision. And what did he see in that dream or vision?
Cross in the sky.
Some signal, some sign, symbol, excuse me, either a cross or the Cairo. Something like this or this. What's this symbol?
Christ.
Peace. Okay. So it's the first two letters for in Greek when you spell it Christ. X is chi, and then the P is actually an R. So Christos. I can't actually spell the Greek, but so that's the first two letters. And so we don't exactly know which symbol It was. But Constantine, the general, saw in his vision or dream a symbol and was told, by this sign you shall conquer. And so he put this symbol, whether it's a cross or a Kyro, onto the shields and weapons of his people, of his soldiers. And then he won. And so he reunified the Roman Empire, and he credited his victory to the Christian God. And so he legalized Christianity in 313. Now, what's the ramification of this? What's the biggest consequence of the legalization of Christianity? Well, they were a persecuted minority, and now it's legal. You can worship publicly now. So they didn't have to worship in secret in house churches anymore. They could use public, bigger public spaces for worship. Now, another thing, too, since it was actually allowed now, more and more people joined the church. So the number of Christians grew exponentially. In order to accommodate this, the bishops actually delegated more of their authority to lead worship to presbyters or priests. And so there were more parish priests. Priests became mini bishops, simply celebrating Mass. And then they took on these big spaces called basilicas for worship. Now, the basilica was actually sort of the court, sort of a big building used for legal stuff, for court, or also for market dealing. So it's a public space. Usually a rectangular room with two circular half-circle areas. Now at the top, as you can see, is sort of a tribunal. That's where the judge sat in the secular basilica. And then there's this rectangular space in the middle where people gather. Now they took on that building space for worship. And instead of the judge, it was now the bishop, or the presider who sat up there in the apse, that half circle up on top. And then there was the altar over there, and then the nave was where the people worshipped. Here's another picture, another diagram, what it would have looked like. So the cathedral is the chair. That's the reason why we call the cathedral a cathedral, because that's where the bishop's chair is. And then the altar is there in the sanctuary, up there in the apse. And then there is sort of this space in the middle where the choir of singers sat. And then to the left and the right, you had the women and the men. So they worshiped separate. They were divided. So around this time, the first few centuries, the liturgy was still in the language of the people, usually Latin or Greek. In the city of Rome, the main language was Latin. And then in outside areas, the more urban language, more sophisticated language was Greek. But more and more, as time passed, Latin became the preferred language of worship in the West. Now, I think I started talking about this last week, but the word liturgy, what does it mean? We use this term a lot to refer to worship, time of prayer. You remember? Work of the people. So, letos and turgos. So, from two words, of the people. And so now this was actually a secular term The liturgy was something that you did for the government, for the people. Sort of like jury duty. You had to do it for the state. But Christians adopted this term of worship, this term for worship. Now it's used to say that Christians are doing this for the church, participating in the work of God. So, not just for the state, but for God and for the people of God. So here are two examples of churches, early churches. Now, even in Rome, if you go to Rome, none of the churches there have been completely preserved intact, so we can't really exactly tell what a church looked like exactly in the 400s or 300s. So a lot of them have been renovated, of course, throughout history. But here we get a good sense of what an early church looked like. So this is the Basilica of San Clemente in Rome. And so we see from the diagram above, it fits the structure of the basilica style of worship. There in the middle, you have the area for the choir. And then along the side aisles, that's where the people stood. There weren't any pews or chairs. Usually worship was done standing up at this time. And then up far over there, you have the half-circular area, and the bishop's chair was right there. And then the altar was usually highlighted by what's called a Baltican or ciborium. Now, interestingly enough, ciborium is actually a term that we use for another thing. What do we use ciborium for? Yes, so the ciborium is sort of like a chalice where you keep the host. But this, the Baltican or ciborium, is sort of like a tent. Something like that over the altar. And there are some evidence that we have that actually the altar was covered. There were times when it would be covered in cloth and the people couldn't actually see it. This is sort of a reference to the Old Testament Ark of the Covenant. The meeting tent. And so the holy sacrifice of the Mass was so sacred, so intimate, that oftentimes it's veiled.
If you go into the Greek Orthodox Church on the one over in Louisville,
yes,
they have the curtain.
Yep, the screen, absolutely. Yes, in Eastern Rite Catholics or Orthodox churches, they still have that. Another thing, too, so not all of the churches had that, some of them did. Another thing, too, was they built altars over the shrines or the places where the martyrs or the saints were buried. Here's one example. The Basilica of Santa Sabina in Rome. This is sort of cut off over here, but you can probably see in your drawing, in your notes on the next one. The altar is over this platform, and underneath is actually where the remains of a saint is laid. If you go to Rome, to St. Peter's Basilica, any of you have been to St. Peter's Basilica? So a few of you have. Now, of course, that was renovated. The current St. Peter's Basilica was built in the 1400s, 1500s, around there. But you still have that remains of the altar being built over a sacred space. So they didn't have worship in the catacombs anymore, but you still had this continuity of having worship with those who were holy, who came before us, who testified to their faith by their lives. And here too you have that choir area that's screened off from the people and others. Any questions before we go? Yes?
When was the church start being laid out like a cross? Was that back?
That came a bit later, usually when you had Romanesque and Romanesque churches and Gothic churches that were laid in that longer rectangular area with two transepts. So we'll see that in the next class, actually. So that's a very good question. Thank you. Okay. Now the next important person that we have here as we move from the early church to the Middle Ages is actually Pope Gregory the Great, St. Gregory the Great.
Can I just
yes.
Okay. Here in the early Middle Ages it says High Mass versus Low Mass. Isn't that a distinction anymore?
Sort of. We'll talk more about that. Thank you. We'll definitely talk more about that.
Not like it was then.
Yes, absolutely, yes. Thank you. Yes, so around this time, in the 400s was when the western part of the Roman Empire fell. So Constantine moved the capital of the empire to the east. Do you remember the city?
Constantinople.
Byzantium, Constantinople. And so he moved the capital over there, and the west became much more vulnerable. There was a lot of barbarians, Goths, that were there. And so Rome, the city of Rome, which was actually not as heavily guarded anymore, fell to the barbarians in the 400s. And the emperors, who were in the east, couldn't really defend it. So guess who stepped up to take on leadership roles? The Pope. So the Pope wasn't just a bishop anymore. He was also, in many ways, a civic leader by this time. And so they gained prominence and power and responsibility. And one of the great popes, we even call him the Great, was Pope Gregory I. Gregory was a monk. Around this time, monasticism wasn't actually seen as just a group of people on a hill living an isolated life. Monks were actually also, ironically, they were missionaries. A lot of them were sent out to evangelize the rest of Europe. Gregory, who was a monk himself, sent out other monks. He sent St. Augustine of Canterbury, a different Augustine than Augustine of Hippo. He sent Augustine and Anselm to England. And then St. Boniface went to Germany. And all these monks brought other monks with them, started monasteries, and started churches. And that's how a big part of Europe was evangelized. So there was a growing influence of monasticism in the church, and also, as we shall see, in worship. Around this time, we started developing Gregorian chant. Now, here's something I forgot to mention earlier. In this picture, I don't know how well you can see it in your pictures. Do you notice two platforms there? To the left and to the right. There are evidences in the early church, in some early churches, that there were actually two ambos. One over here. To the right, on the epistle side, and over here, on the gospel side. Those of you who remember the old rite before the Second Vatican Council probably remember that the Old Testament reading, or the epistle, the first reading, was done on the right side. and the gospel was proclaimed on this side. And around this time, too, the Psalms were the main way of singing. There was sort of this distrust of musical instruments. We didn't have organ yet, and we didn't use any harps or you know, any other wind or string instruments in worship. It was just the human voice. Now it got more and more elaborate. And so by the early Middle Ages, by the 6th century, you have Gregorian chant. Oftentimes it's traced back to Pope Gregory, but he's not the one completely responsible. And they're still mostly based on the Psalms. So parts of the Mass, you would have Psalms that would be sang at the beginning, you know, after the first reading, sort of like the responsorial psalm right now, offertory, communion, all of these chants based on simple melodies that people could remember. Around this time, not a lot of people were able to read. And so things were a little simpler. And the monks were the ones who memorized these texts and chanted them for worship. Now around this time, we developed private masses. As you mentioned, low mass versus high mass. Now, part of this was because of Pope Gregory. Pope Gregory said, the best thing we can do for the souls in purgatory is to offer a mass for them. Yeah, you pretty much know that. No. And so he said the mass was the highest form of worship, and so the best thing you can do to intercede for their soul is to offer a mass for them. And so monasteries, originally monks weren't all priests, but more and more monks became priests in order to say masses for the dead. And so in the basilicas, in the churches, you started having site altars. So each priest could say a mass for the dead, or more than one mass each day. And so we still have that custom right now. We have mass attentions for the dead. And so some of these masses were just very, very simple. It didn't matter necessarily. A mass could be very, very grand and beautiful, or it could be very, very simple, but it had the exact same effect, power. The mass is the mass. It's a holy sacrifice. And so what developed was this distinction between a low mass, which was just done by a priest and a server. Server responded for the people. And then high mass, where you would have cantors singing the psalms, singing during most of the mass. And so now, we'll get to this more next week. Unofficially, we still do, like a daily mass is much simpler than a Sunday mass, but it's still a very, very different way of thinking than high mass versus low mass. So, any questions? So around this time, too, worship was becoming a little bit more distant. You had monks and others who specialized in singing. And so that's why people didn't necessarily sing anymore in worship and participate. In order to fill that great need, people turned to devotions. This is the start of private devotions. They visited relics, shrines, and did pilgrimages and other ways to get close to the sacred, as worship was becoming more and more farther away. Now, the next important person that we're going to talk about is Charlemagne. Who was Charlemagne? He was the Frankish king in Gaul. And parts of Germany, basically. And he was his great ruler. And he was recognized by the Pope as a leader who would, in many ways, rebuild civilization in the West. As you know, as I mentioned, the barbarians pillaged Rome, and so for a couple of years it was called the Dark Ages, because a lot of the buildings were destroyed. Culture, the main ones that kept culture and learning alive were the monks. There weren't a lot of other schools. People would send their children to monasteries to learn, but otherwise there wasn't a lot of other developments. And so the church also needed a strong leader, secular leader. The popes themselves just couldn't lead. And so Pope Leo III crowned Charlemagne the Holy Roman Emperor in the year 800. And what he did, what Charlemagne did, was he helped standardize worship. Around this time, the way people worshipped in Rome was a little different than how people worshipped in, say, parts of France, parts of what's now Spain. And so worship was a little bit localized. It wasn't very standard. Charlemagne was getting a little irritated with that. And so he said, he sent a messenger to the Pope and said, okay, send us the book that they use for Mass in Rome, and we want that. And so the Pope sent him a sacramentary, the missal. Now the problem was, he still didn't have the printing press around this time, and so things were copied by hand, but sometimes there's mistakes, there's some things that are missing, and the sacramentary, the book that was given by the Pope to Charlemagne, had lots and lots of missing things and mistakes. And so he ordered his best scholars, thinkers, and priests, and monks to try to fix it, to fill in what's missing there. And so they added more and more German elements to the Mass. Now, before this, the Mass in the city of Rome was actually somewhat simple. Sure, there was incense, but that was already used before the time of Christians. It was used for civic leaders and other worship. But otherwise, worship was actually quite simple. But Charlemagne wanted grander things. He wanted more dramatic things. It was at this time that they added the elevation to the Mass. Oh. Do this in memory of me.
Wow. Cool.
Before that, the priest didn't necessarily show the host or the chalice to the people. And so there's much more dramatic gestures that were added. And then, since Charlemagne was the main leader in the West, that new enriched missal, sacramentary, ended up its way back in Rome, and the Pope adopted it. And so it became more standardized in the West. Now, another thing that drove Charlemagne nuts was that there were lots of monks, and a lot of monasteries had mixed rules. They sort of followed the rule of St. Benedict, but they didn't. Did other things. And so they said, nope, we're just going to actually use the rule of St. Benedict. And so monasticism became more standardized this time too. And so what ended up happening, especially with the missionary monks, Benedictines, was they spread out this new rite, which was Franco-Germanic, so Charlemagne, and Roman to this hybrid Franco-Germanic rite was spread out throughout the West. So this is just some pictures today of Aachen Cathedral. the main church of Charlemagne. It was actually circular, interestingly enough. But you begin to see the roots of the Romanesque style of church with lots of arches there. Just a quick trivia. Have any of you been to St. Meinrad?
Yes.
To the Arch Abbey Church at St. Meinrad. Does this altar look familiar? That is actually where we patterned our altar at St. Meinrad and Abbey Church after after Charlemagne's altar in the Palatine Chapel of Aachen Cathedral. So that sort of gold or bronze squares there depicting scenes from the life of Christ. So, and then the stained glass windows and stuff were actually later additions. But for the most part, this is you see the early design of Charlemagne's church in Aachen in what's now known as West Germany, western part of Germany. So as I mentioned, there was a growing emphasis on transcendence, which is sort of seeing God as up there while we are down here. Just having a sense of awe at God's majesty and power. And so some of the things that happened around the Middle Ages was the movement of the altar. Early on, there was a lot of freestanding altars like we had now. Now, this is actually a little controversial. They were freestanding, and let's go back here. Actually, it's not just me. So in this church, the only way, this is in Rome, so I'm just telling you now, the only way you could actually say Mass is facing the people. But later on, there were also other proof that Mass was said facing away from the people. So this is the controversial part. It depends on the liturgist, the liturgical historian that you ask. But some liturgists would actually tell you that whether the altar was facing the people or not, the people all faced east in the early church. So if the only way was facing this way, then around the Eucharistic prayer, the congregation, supposedly, according to some liturgical historians, would also, around the time of consecration, face east. Now, if east is over here, and the bishop or the priest and the people would all face the same direction. Now, one thing that started to change is that the altar started moving farther and farther, so now it's actually against the wall there in the apse. And so the only way to celebrate Mass was actually facing the same direction as the people. Another development, too, was the multiplication of altars. Why do we need more altars now?
Private masses.
What's that?
Private masses.
Exactly. As I mentioned just a few minutes away, for masses of the dead, for private masses. So that more priests could celebrate Mass at the same time. They didn't necessarily have a celebration before. And interestingly enough, too, we saw the slow disappearance of the ambos. In churches, they didn't necessarily have ambos anymore at this time. And it'll, as we'll see next week, it will return in a different form as a pulpit, which is actually technically different than an ambo. And then the scola cantorum, professional choirs or singers who would chant the psalms. They did most of the singing. They memorized the text. And so people's participation in singing diminished. And also in some churches, we see what's called a rood screen, the Western version of the Orthodox iconostasis. In the East, we have these icon screens covering the altar. But in the West, we didn't necessarily have icons covering it, but you would have this gate. And it's called a rood screen because the word rood is actually an old English term for cross. So that's where the crucifix was. It's cut off from here, but it's a cross up there and a cross up there, sort of a gate. Now later on, what we'll see is actually that rood screen will get smaller and smaller to the point that it'll become the communion rail. And here are just some diagrams. We'll talk more about this next time. The development of Romanesque architecture in the Middle Ages. The church has gotten more elaborate. And here you have the beginnings of the cruciform pattern of the church. And so the altar is up there. And the choir as well, and then the side arms, and then the lower part was where the people gathered. And we have a lot of different side altars dedicated to saints, where priests could celebrate private masses for the dead and other intentions. Each chapel also had relics, and so when people couldn't participate as much in worship anymore, they tried to fill this gap by visiting relics, relic shrines, and other devotions, as we'll talk more about in the next class, pilgrimages. So what I just want to say in this first part of the history, for the first 1,000 years, was that I see a gradual shift of understanding of worship from a more imminent style of worship, where early Christians had more intimate, closer worship in house churches, going to much, much more transcendent, grander worship, more dramatic gestures, bigger worship spaces, and just grander way of expressing God's transcendence, His greatness, His power and majesty. In the first 1,000 years. And we'll see this pattern again in the next class, next week. And right now we're just trying to look for the right balance between God's closeness and reverence for God's majesty. So nevertheless, there was a constant understanding that it is the highest and most central prayer of the church. Any questions? Yes, Carol.
So around near the end here where you were talking about the iconostasis,
yes,
and the rood, did the Eastern Church, the Orthodox, always have the iconostasis? Or did that also gradually just across the church come into being?
I think we had a lot of common ground. So basically, the Church of Rome, the Catholic Church, and the Orthodox Church is split in the year 1054. So before that, we also, all of us were Catholics. All of us belonged to the Catholic Church. And if you were a Catholic, you were called an Orthodox Christian, because you believe in the Orthodox teachings, the right teachings of the church. And then after the split, that's when we started calling ourselves not Catholics, and they were calling themselves Orthodox. So we had a lot of common ground, but worship was outside the West. Worship was very localized and not as standardized as us. And so I think there were some elements that we shared. Like here in Venice, to the left. It sort of had an iconostasis up top, had a row of icons. Venice was an important area because that's in northern Italy, and that's where a lot of people in the 7th century, 7th and 8th centuries actually, 8th, 7th and 8th century, there was the iconoclastic controversy. So in the East, some people were challenging the use of icons, saying we can't really depict God, we can't really depict the saints. We were told in the Ten Commandments we shouldn't have graven images, sort of like a Protestant objection later on. And so for a time, people in the East were destroying icons and statues, and a lot of the icons were actually smuggled to Italy. And so that's why in Venice there's a lot of Eastern influence. So there was some connection in the East and West. Venice, especially Ravenna, had Eastern influences. But otherwise, I think they developed somewhat independently in Rome and in the Eastern churches. So there's some things that had common shared traditions, and then there's some things that just grew independently. But I think early on, I think it's very clear that there was a sense that the altar, the sanctuary, was a sacred space. And so it was either partitioned off with a rood screen, or it was covered by a ciborium. And so it was just that sacred area. So, good question.
So the question, yes, Karen. So the Mass was on Sunday. How long was the Mass? From 2 hours, 3 hours, you know, 1 hour?
In which time period?
Well, I guess I'm wondering just in the first 1,000 years.
In the early church, we didn't have standardized texts yet for worship. And so basically the priest was just directed to offer thanks and use, at some point during the Eucharistic prayer, use the words that Jesus used, take this, all of you, and eat of it. And so I think that probably varied considerably depending on the area. Some priests would probably, if they were just making up the prayer right there, some priests would probably be more long-winded than others, I would imagine. But later on, no, that's right. Later on, things became more standard. The current Eucharistic prayer, too, the shortest one that we have right now, actually was one of the earliest ones. It was written by Hippolytus in apostolic traditions, this early church document. And then another very old Eucharistic prayer is actually Eucharistic Prayer 1, which is the longest one, which you mentioned, which we'll see next week. They mention all the important Roman saints, starting with the apostles, and then with Lawrence, Linus, Cletus, Clement, Cornelius, Sixtus, all those people. John and Paul, George and Ringo, and all the saints. But that's longer. And so I guess it depended on the Eucharistic prayer too, and the text that was being read. But in the Eastern churches, if you've been to Orthodox Divine Liturgy, it can be long. It can be like 2 or 3 hours long. And so the Roman rite has always been much simpler than the Eastern rite. They use like incense all throughout the Mass, all the liturgy, and has a lot more symbols than us.
Do everything 3 times.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yes, Karen.
I'm going to look at what you're covering in the next session, but I was wondering if you're going to cover the Eucharist and the change in the form and distribution of it, how it was distributed. In the early church,
yes.
The breaking of the bread, and
yes.
How did they do that, and when did it come to the form that it is now?
Yes, we will. Yes, we will definitely see that. There is some evidence that some churches, I know in the Eastern Church, they've always used leavened bread. Their understanding is the unleavened bread that they used in the Passover meal in the Old Testament was about the Old Covenant. So you ate the bread as if you were in a hurry Is it like the Israelites, they were on a journey, because there was unleavened bread and stuff, and then the new covenant for them signaled a change to leavened bread. Whereas in the West, I think for the most part, we've kept the tradition of actually using unleavened bread for worship. I think I mentioned last week, some, this is not official, of course, but some people, some liturgical historians say that the Mass, remember this? The Mass, Misa, other than Missio, mission, was also because of matzah, flatbread, Jewish flatbread. But they use Passover. And so I think in the West, for the most part, I think we've kept the use of unleavened bread from the Old Testament, from Hebrew worship, Jewish worship. So, well, thank you very, very much. I don't want to keep you all here. If you have any questions, come forward. I'll try to see if I can answer your questions or encourage you. But thank you very much.